The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Virtuoso Life magazine, National Geographic Traveler, and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of those cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that could be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Now, today on Armchair Traveler, we begin with a short article that comes from the Sustainable Travel Spotlight column, which is found in the July-August 2019 issue of travel industry publication Virtuoso Life. Now, this publication is geared toward travel industry professionals, but sometimes they feature some interesting articles you might enjoy. And featured is the Big Five Tours and Expeditions president, Ashish Sangrajka, who offers his views on over-tourism, giving back, and destinations on the rise. So let's see what he has to say. Tour operator Big Five keeps sustainability at the heart of all its trips. The company also operates the Spirit of Big Five Foundation, established to formalize the responsible tourism concepts Ashish Sangrajka's family has supported since his father founded the company in 1973. And then here's a series of questions. There's three of them and his answer. First one, tell us about the Spirit of Big Five Foundation. And here's his answer. It's 90% funded by family endowment. We have two really active regional projects we support. The first is the Awamaki Foundation in Peru, where we're helping empower women in Andean communities, teaching them how to earn money through weaving and land contract work with hotels and stores in major cities. In northern Sri Lanka, a country that's only been living in peace for less than 15 years, there's a bit of a lost generation that went through the Civil War. We work with a development program that teaches young people applicable skills and helps them find local travel and tourism jobs. Next question, what's the biggest threat to travel and tourism right now? Answer, over-tourism is today's major issue. Look at things like the defacing of Angkor Wat or the closing of an entire island, Boracay, off the coast of the Philippines. Respecting fair pricing and focusing on quality over quantity can lead to controlled tourism numbers, but most importantly, local citizens must have a seat at the table. There still has to be a sense of ownership from all sides, both domestic and foreign. And the final question, which destinations are Big Five travelers seeking out? Colombia is our fastest growing destination, as he starts out his answer. We have our own offices in Bogota and Cartagena. Tourism is now the country's second largest export after oil and just ahead of coffee. We've recently launched tours in Ethiopia, and we're watching it very closely. Everyone has returned completely blown away. Our most popular destinations are South Africa and Peru. So there's a travel industry expert giving us his points of view, and I hope that gives you some information. Next, we're going to feature some articles that come under the umbrella of eclectic exploring. And first up is an interview with a travel industry executive who recently climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. Now, this interview, also found in the Virtuoso Life section of the July-August 2019 issue of Virtuoso Life magazine. And as he puts it, this is climbing the African summit of a lifetime. Virtuoso Director of Marketing Technology, Matt Elliott, recently joined 19 Virtuoso-affiliated agency owners and hoteliers for a hike to the top of 19,341-foot Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. The group booked a six-day trip with Abercrombie and Kent, 5 days up and 1 day down. On this shorter itinerary, adjusting to the altitude is a bit more challenging than on the typical 9-day trek, but everyone in Elliott's group reached the summit, in fact. A&K boasts an overall 97% summit success rate. This trip is all about the memories, the people helping you get there, the friends you're climbing with, the sunrise at summit, Elliott says. It's a physically, mentally, and emotionally challenging journey that I wouldn't trade for anything. Here now are his tips for reaching the summit and enjoying every step. Now's the time is the first one. The mountain gets more visitors every year, and its glaciers have receded dramatically in the last decade, he says. Go now while it's still a relatively intimate experience. Pre-trip prep. And he says, follow the training guidelines your tour operator gives you. I even did some of my CrossFit workouts in the hiking boots I'd be wearing. It's extremely important to have well-fitting broken boots. And just an aside for you, my wife and I enjoy walking in our neighborhood in North Raleigh, and we see people with backpacks and things, and we find out they're actually getting ready for hiking excursions and things. So this is a good way to get in shape and to get ready. Next up is top tour guides, and Matt tells us, Dismas, our lead guide and A&K support staff, were some of the hardest working people I've ever met. They carried our gear up to 40 pounds per person plus their own up the mountain and prepared each day's camp, including tents with comfortable mattresses and pillows. Kind of hard to envision mattresses and pillows as you're climbing a mountain. And anyway, next, encouraging words. If we struggled at times during the hike, the staff would give us friendly smiles and a jambo, that's a hello, or a hakuna matata, no trouble. They made sure we were safe, healthy, comfortable, and doing everything right to reach the summit. How about mountain cuisine? Well, Matt says the menu was designed to keep us healthy and give us energy, but it was tasty. After a six-mile hike, it was refreshing to enjoy a hearty soup, stew, or chicken dish. How about some packing tips? Well, I didn't need all the protein bars I packed. Your appetite might not be what you think it will. I'd wish I'd brought some prosciutto or charcuterie as a little extravagance like my Italian friends did. Bring a backbone, or rather a backup phone battery. Cell service is spotty, but you'll want it for photos. Layers are the key. I liked having zip-off pant legs. Hydration upgrade. You'll drink 3 to 5 liters of water a day. Bring electrolyte tablets and start hydrating with them on the flight over. They make drinking water a little more enjoyable and help your body replace lost minerals. Freshening up. There were a couple of shower tents, but I didn't shower. Instead, I used the wash basins A&K set up at the tents with hot water for a sponge bath. The weather was excellent, so it wasn't uncomfortable. And sage advice. You may not understand why your guide is asking you to do something like deep breathing exercises and measuring your blood oxygen saturation before meals, but it all pays off when you see the incredible sunrise at the summit. There's another tip, this one offered by Tanya Swasbrook. She is a Virtuoso agency executive who's based in San Diego. Her tip, plan at least 6 months out from your trek in order to train, actually do hikes, and break in your boots. It's a life-changing experience, and the tech detox is liberating, but be prepared for rugged hiking and camping. So some good tips and information there if you're going on a hiking excursion. Well, talking about exploring and hiking and so forth, the Explorer's Guide section of the June-July 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler offers tips for those who might want to explore, of all things, volcanoes. Let's find out more. To me, volcanoes are the most tangible phenomena showing that our planet is alive, says volcanologist Arianna Sadati, a National Geographic Explorer worldwide. There are about 1,500 active volcanoes, some of which are sacred to local populations. Before you visit one, be sure to learn about beliefs surrounding the peak and get an update on the volcanic activity. Once you're there, allow plenty of time for wonder. Here are three of Sodati's picks for Earth's most fiery destinations, and this according to writer Katie Kornavsky. First up is Stromboli, Italy. This island north of Sicily is known as the lighthouse of the Mediterranean due to its frequent volcanic activity and the way its incandescent explosions illuminate the night sky. With a mild eruption at least every 20 minutes, the lava fountain is a sure bet for travelers, says Sodati. Join a 3-hour guided tour hike to reach the summit by sunset and from a safe platform peer down at the glowing, bursting spectacle. Then we have the Erta Al in Ethiopia. In the scorched afar desert of Ethiopia, Erta Al is the site that Sodati calls the only somewhat accessible lava lake, the southernmost pit of this constantly active, low-profile structure. An example of a shield volcano has been dubbed the Gateway to Hell. Intrepid travelers can hire an adventure guide who'll lead them to hot glimpses of the smoldering scene. Then we have Reunion, France, located in the Indian Ocean, some 420 miles east of Madagascar. This French island features a stunning range of volcanic landscapes, Sodati says. Visitors can explore the cinder cones, caldera, and lava flows on foot and by car or helicopter. Every 9 months, on average, Reunion's shield volcano Piton de la Fournaise puts on an amazing show of pyrotechnics. So there you go. And quite an interesting array of things there. And by the way, another good one is Kilauea in Hawaii. We'll try to update that one. My wife and I enjoyed going almost to the rim of that before the big eruption last year. But this was in about a year before, in 2017. So that's another one to put on your list. I would highly recommend it once they get that straightened out. Well, if exploring volcanoes whets your travel fancy, you might also enjoy exploring caves. How about that? Okay. Well, writer John Briley has done that, and he has an article, Under the Shenandoah Mountains, a West Virginia Caving Adventure. This article found in the April 5th, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. So let us begin. In the moist elemental rind of the earth, the balance shifts. I am on my belly, twisting through a subterranean, mud-slicked limestone passage in West Virginia, and for the first time, legitimately trying to keep up with my 10-year-old son, Kai. I'm here with him, his friends Curtis and Fenn, and a guide on a late March Tuesday exploring one of the state's 5,000 known caves, most of which, like this one, have no parking lot, interior lighting, gift shop, or even signage. In fact, our guide, Lester Zook, agreed to take us in this cave on the condition that I reveal neither its name nor its precise location. So, we're somewhat outside the one stoplight town of Franklin, above a bucolic valley west of the Shenandoah Mountains, where hills choked with oak and hickory trees rise and fall like banjo rolls. Like many parents of preteens, I toss around cliches about how many kids run circles around me, but honestly, if it came down to a foot race or weightlifting or free throws, Vegas wouldn't even post odds. But here, in the slippery pothole dermis of our planet, the boys move fully like adapted insects, nimble, flexible, flowing, while I lurch like, well, a 52-year-old dad in need of a yoga routine. Fortunately, Zook has my back. When you move in a cave, do so slowly, he says. We stand in early spring sunshine beneath a rock wall, pondering the pumpkin-sized hole at our feet, our portal to adventure. There's seldom a reason to be in a hurry, he says. Zook, 58, is a wiry 5'6", an ideal build for crawling around underground. He's clad in well-worn blue overalls, or coveralls, with integrated knee and elbow pads and hiking shoes. As he instructed when I called him, we're dressed for mud, as if 10-year-olds ever aren't, and for near-constant 52-degree Fahrenheit air. The temperature in caves holds steady at the annual mean temperature of a region, plus or minus a degree. Zook views backcountry activity as an antidote to the smother of safety and structure children face in the modern world. The outdoors is basically a giant gymnasium, he tells me, and it's different than traditional sports. There's no coach, no screaming audience, no humiliation or bench time. The kids can just be themselves. With, of course, a few rules. He leads us through a safety briefing, checks our helmets and headlamps, ensures everyone has a whistle, and asks the boys how they think people find their way through cave systems. Yes, Zook confirms some mark walls with a spray paint, but that's bad eco-juju and in many places illegal. No, people don't leave trails of crumbs. As for those who rely on their memories, Zook says we have a word for them, lost. He then pulls out his favorite method, a map and a compass, and gives a brief primer on how to use them before dropping to hands and knees and leading us underground. The hole opens to a descending crevice, and we down climb 15 feet of puddle-laden ledges until we reach a relatively level path, narrow enough that we can touch the walls on both sides. After a few twists and turns, this alleyway opens to a dome the size of a large dining room. We're in a rock world. On one side, the ages have stacked multi-ton slabs of limestone like hastily shuffled playing cards. Shadows dance across the walls, ceiling, floors, and geologic clutter, which run the gamut of brown, russet, sand, walnut, tan, chocolate, khaki. Water drips from stalactites that finger down from the ceiling, the smallest of which are known as soda straws, each dropping leaving behind a residue of calcite that further extends the formation, a geologic process set on hyperspeed. In many places, the calcite is fashioning stalagmites on the ground, glossy nubs that appear translucent white in the center. Some of these have bubbled together into flowstones, alluringly smooth formations that resemble miniaturized caramel mountain ranges. There is nothing uniform or familiar here, although the faint mineral smell nudges at my ancestral memory, and my mind, after decades above ground, conjures likenesses, a construction site demolition pile, an earthquake-crippled bridge, a stream bed, or coral reef. Most of the world's caves are limestone, formed over eons as water filtered through the ground and combined with decaying organic matter to create carbonic acid, which in turn bored through seams in the rock. This process has yielded some spectacular systems, like the 400-plus miles of passages and chambers in Mammoth Caves National Park in Kentucky. Vietnam's Hang Song Duong, which is the world's largest cave by volume, and contains its own rainforest and river. The one we're in covers less than a half mile. We sit and switch off our lights. Total darkness, as in can't see your hand an inch from your face dark. 10,000 feet under the sea dark, or yeah, deep in a cave in West Virginia dark. I can't see anything, Finn says, and what I hope is more amazement than terror. Total darkness is one of the factors that makes a cave versus, say, a hole. To earn the label, caves for cabins, there's no difference, must also have formed naturally and be big enough to hold a person. I'm enjoying the complete shutdown of one of my most used senses and wondering what it would be like to try to find my way out of here blind when Zook turns his headlamp back on. He assigns Kai and Curtis to Navigation Team A and helps them orient to generate a hypothesis. We think there's a passage around that corner, Curtis says, pointing toward a shadow. Sure enough, the route squeezes through a notch before widening into a room decorated with stalactites and stalagmites, including some in an upper corner that have grown together in 3-foot floor-to-ceiling columns. Around the next bend, Zook points out a hibernating little brown bat about the size and cuteness of a mouse, dangling as if its feet were superglued to the underside of a ledge. Bats are always a welcome sight. They eat mosquitoes, end of discussion, but especially so these days. A fungus called white nose syndrome has killed millions of hibernating bats across North America since 2006. The condition, which confuses the animals and causes them to fly around burning fat they need to survive the winter, gets its name from a white fuzz it leaves on some bats' faces. The disease has waned in the mid-Atlantic region, but based on a theory that humans might inadvertently carry the fungus into caves on their clothes and shoes, the U.S. government has closed many of the caves on federal land. We see few other signs of animal life, just 3 spiders and a small pile of bones, including one that appears to be the vertebrae of a sizable mammal. No clues, Zook says, when I asked the species. Maybe some bear fell in here and couldn't find his way out. Of all the emergencies I imagined, claustrophobia, ankle sprain, boys sprinting off with compass and map, I never considered that we might stumble upon a predator. And Zook says such a confrontation is highly unlikely. Mammals don't wander too far underground, he tells me, although he's heard of cavers encountering groundhogs and coyotes. I also never figured that 460 million years ago the ground beneath my feet might have been a beach, but as we move along, Zook points out clusters of seashell fossils, some so perfectly preserved that I instinctively reached to pick them up, remnants of the vast inland sea that once covered this area. Zook appoints Finn and Kai to Navigation Team B, and what an astute student would take as a harbinger counsels us on how to negotiate extremely tight spaces. If you feel like you're getting stuck or claustrophobic, focus on breathing. Next, work on microscopic movements, or micro-movements, I should say. Often you'll find you can move one body part a little than another. Don't fight the cave. You'll only make things worse. And he adds, never pull or push a person in a tight spot, which might get them entrapped. He recounts a story of a big dude who got stuck in Utah. His friends went down the road to the Cave Rescue Supply Store, also called Walmart, and brought some Vaseline. They came back, stripped their buddy to his boxers, coated as much of him as they could in the Vaseline, and managed to slide him out. We face 2 crawls where I have to back out a few times and reorient my helmet-shoulder-torso alignment to shimmy through. But none are what cavers call chest compressors, spaces so tight that one must fully exhale to make it through and open to larger spaces quickly enough that I don't freak out. Our last stop is the Art Museum, a loft-like nook where visitors have plastered the walls with mud sculptures, a cartoonish skull, An impressive rendition of the James Madison University Duke Dog mascot and other 21st century references that detract ever so slightly from the ancient vibe down here. Kai and I get the final nav team assignment, steering us back to daylight. After we plot the necessary turns, I immediately lead us into a cul-de-sac, proving, left to my own skills in a more labyrinthine cavern, I'd be dead. Well, my son jumps past me. "Dad, let me get in front." He darts around one last corner and heads toward a keyhole of sunlight without looking back. And by the way, our writer, Briley, is based in Tacoma Park outside of Washington, D.C. So there you go. Lots of fun there, caving in Shenandoah in West Virginia. Well, maybe your exploring fancies might include some fishing. Chris Santella, a writer and fly fishing aficionado from Portland, Oregon, is going to take us on a pilgrimage to one of the most popular American trout streams. Now, his article is found in the April 12, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. The tippy tops of the Grand Tetons were just in view to the east above a wisp of clouds as our drift boat floated silently along the glassy waters of the Henry's Fork in Harriman State Park in Idaho. "There are some fish working over there," guide Phil Sagama whispered, motioning to the right as he slowly lowered the anchor to hold our position in the river. At first I saw nothing, but then small dimples were apparent on the surface, a pod of four or five rainbow trout gently sipping tiny insects from the surface. "There are blue-winged olives and mahogany duns on the water," Sagama continued, "but I'm not sure what they're eating." He tied a size 8 sparkle dun on the end of my angling partner Dante Leach's gossamer-thin tippet, a mayfly imitation smaller than my pinky nail. A coyote loped by on the far bank, paying little attention. "I want you to cast so the fly drops about 10 feet above the dimples," Sagama instructed. "Throw a little upstream mend and let it float through." "They look small," Leach said, tossing his fly line behind us to begin his cast. "You'd be surprised," Sagama says. "I'd say those fish are 18 inches. The fly, barely visible in the surface, floated toward the trout armada, which were now making small splashes as they eagerly slurped the bugs. "Be ready," he whispered, as we all craned toward anticipation of the tiny fly's disappearance in a fish's mouth. It reached the center of the pod as fish porpoised on each side and floated upstream, or downstream, unmolested. "I guess we'll try another fly," Sagama said, undeterred. So it goes on the Henry's. Idaho's Henry's Fork, technically the Henry's Fork of the Snake River, begins at Henry's Lake, 15 miles west of Yellowstone National Park, supplemented by cold, clear water from the Big Springs a few miles south of the lake, as well as a number of tributaries. It flows southwest for 127 miles before joining the main stem of the Snake River below Rexburg. It's a river of many shapes and personalities. In some sections, it gurgles through pine forest or pasture with snow-capped mountains hovering in the distance. In others, it crashes through vertiginously steep canyons of frothing white water. Some stretches hold only rainbows, some a mix of brown trout and rainbows, or brook trout and rainbows. One consistent is big sky northern rocky scenery and the opportunity to spy the wildlife that call that region home, including elk and moose, as well as black and grizzly bears. "You have to learn different techniques to find success on different sections of the river," said Sagama, who has guided here since 2008. That's one of the appeals of guiding here. Fly anglers have been plying the Henry's Fork since the early 1900s, though it's really centered the larger angling consciousness in the 1960s and 70s, thanks to the writings of Charles Brooks and Ernest Schweibert. Since that time, every fly angler worth her waders has either fished here or dreamed of doing so. There are rivers where you can find bigger fish and others where you can likely land more. The great lure of the Henry's is the abundance of insect life and the local trout's inclination to seek sustenance on the surface. "If you could design a river for dry fly fishing, this would be it," mused Nelson Ishvama, the founder and owner of Henry Fork Lodge, who has fished the river for 53 years, missing only one season. "It's a very unusual experience, and it has intellectual appeal. You're going to solve a puzzle, determine what the fish are feeding on, and find a fly that's a good imitation. But that puzzle is changing every day. It's always a challenge, but it's also dependable. The fish are almost always feeding on some sort of insect on the surface, Ishivama says. There are at least 18 insect species that appear on the Henrys at various times, multiple variations of each insect, and hundreds of fly patterns that have been created by anglers to trick the trout, or in anglers' parlance, match the hatch. I've been to the Henry 6 years in a row, drawn to its beautiful piscine puzzle. There's a good fishing to be had here throughout the year, though mid-June through October tend to be the most popular times. My base for fishing operations is a lodge called Trout Hunter, which sits on the River Island Park. Trout Hunter offers comfortable rooms, and its restaurant and bar is the main gathering spot for local and visiting anglers alike. More importantly, Trout Hunter offers one of the most seasoned and competent guide staffs I've encountered over the many years of fly fishing travel. On my first time out, I had zero expectation of catching any fish and expected to make a mess of things, says Wang Cheng, a returning guest from Kuala Lumpur. Instead, I caught 13, thanks to my very patient and excellent guide, who was always encouraging, never pressured me, and corrected my casting throughout the day. I'm sure the whole river could hear me as I screamed fish every time I hooked one. Our job here is to discover where clients are in their fishing journey and try to deliver what they're hoping for, said Pat Gaffney, a recovering attorney from Connecticut with a billowing beard who's been guiding trout hunters since 2007. I'd like to say there are four stages of trout fishing. One, I've never done this before. I want to catch one. Two, I want to catch them all. Three, I want to catch the big fish or the hard-to-fool fish. Four, I'm just happy to be here. We have clients from 8 to 80 on the river. The fishing day begins at breakfast and the lodge when guides pop by your table to plan the day. After breakfast, you grab your waders and rod and drive to the river. Most fishing is done from a drift boat or raft. During my most recent visit, several anglers in our group opted to fish the Cardiac Canyon stretch. To reach the river, you descend nearly 600 feet over a quarter mile. Watching your guide bounce the raft up and down the steep rocky trail is worth the effort itself. Though in this wilderness stretch, added rewards come in the form of animal encounters and especially eager rainbows and browns. As Cardiac Canyon sees few anglers, my friends saw two black bears on their float. Another group floating the river below Big Springs came upon a family of moose. My favorite float on the Henrys is the Harriman section, known as among the regulars as the Ranch. The river here is broad and moves slow and smooth around lazy horseshoe bends. But there are many tiny currents that don't immediately meet the eye, microcurrents that can make an imperfectly presented fly skitter across the water unnaturally, sending fish scurrying for cover. Casts that slap the water or create too many shadows have the same result. And so he goes back to Trout Hunter and says, we gathered for a few drinks to swap fishing stories. Between tales, I wandered outside to the patio overlooking the river. Sure enough, there were a few dimples on the surface. Trout were still feeding. I hustled to my room, slid into my waders, and grabbed my rod and fishing vest. The sun was beginning to dip behind the centennials, but it would be light for at least 15 minutes more, spoken like a true fisherman. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We want you to listen next time and hope you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously Triangle Radio Reading Service, the content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138.